Hello everyone. I'm delighted to be with you today to discuss the regulatory enforcement and disciplinary actions of the Stock Exchange and the SFC, which have taken place between May to August 2022. I'll begin today by giving you an overview of the trends of enforcement and disciplinary actions conducted by the Stock Exchange and the SFC between May to August 2022. I'll then look at the key disciplinary and enforcement cases which have taken place during the same period of time, and dive into each of these cases by discussing their key facts and findings and the corresponding bases and rationale of the disciplinary and enforcement actions. During the period from May to August 2022, we continue to see that the Stock Exchange was enforcing the exchange's listing rules and the Directors' Form B undertaking by conducting enforcement actions targeting corporate misconduct or misgovernance and internal control failures. We also noticed that the Stock Exchange considered the steps taken by individual directors for discharging their responsibilities in respect of internal controls in the course of potential breaches. From the enforcement actions of the SFC, we've seen that it's also been focusing on larger and more impactful cases involving large-scale licensed corporations and imposing sanctions with a relatively large amount of fines. The SFC also leveraged its sanctioning tools of reprimand and fines, and by way of initiating proceedings in the Market Misconduct Tribunal so as to achieve its enforcement objectives. Let me begin by considering the Exchange's disciplinary actions in May 2022. Firstly, on the 5th of May 2022, the Exchange censured Wuzhou International Holdings and imposed a prejudice to investors' interest statement against two executive directors, Mr. Xu Zicheng and Mr. Xu Ziwan. On the same day, the exchange criticized seven other former directors and directed them to attend training on regulatory and legal topics and listing rule compliance. Between January 2017 and December 2018, Wuzhou carried out nine transactions which involved an acquisition and disposal of equity interests in certain subsidiaries. Eight transactions constituted disclosable transactions, while one of them was a very substantial disposal for a consideration in aggregate of over 1.1 billion RMB. Based on an independent investigation initiated by RSM Corporate Advisory, who were Wuzhou's restructuring advisor engaged in August 2018, it found that among the transfer of equity interests in some of the subsidiaries of Wuzhou, there were 15 which were not approved by Wuzhou's board of directors in 2018, and these included, amongst others, six disposals which constituted notifiable transactions, of which five constituted disclosable transactions, while one of them was a very substantial disposal. Wuzhou had never announced the additional disposals with the details required under Rule 14.58 of the listing rules, and only had disclosed brief information about them in its 2018 annual report, published on the 24th of September 2020. For a notifiable transaction, such as a disclosable transaction or a very substantial disposal, Listing Rule 14.58 requires disclosure of specified details in the announcement, such as the basis upon which the consideration was determined and the reasons for entering into the transaction. Mr. Xu Zicheng, former chairman and ED, and Mr. Xu Ziwan, former Chairman, Chief Executive Officer and ED, were both involved in the negotiations for the transactions and the additional disposals and the handling of the relevant agreements. They consequently had knowledge of the transactions and the additional disposals at the material time. The use of Wuzhou subsidiary's CHOPS required Mr. Xu Ziwan's approval when he was the Chairman, Chief Executive and Executive Director, and such CHOPS were affixed to the agreements for those transactions. Neither Mr. Xu Ziwan nor Mr. Xu Zicheng informed the Board of Directors at the material time of the transactions, apart from the third disposal and the additional disposals when they were entered into. Among the transactions, there was a disposal referred to in the financial statements in the 2017 annual report, and this was presented to the Board for review and approval at a Board meeting in March 2018. However, none of the directors raised any inquiries into the second disposal, nor into any related listing rule compliance issues. The listing committee made a number of key findings. Pursuant to Listing Rule 1434, as soon as possible after the terms of a disclosable transaction or very substantial disposal have been finalized, the listed company must inform the stock exchange and publish an announcement. Wuzhou breached listing rule 1434 when it delayed announcing each of the transactions and the additional disposals. It also breached listing rules 1438A, 1448, and 1449 in failing to issue a circular and obtain shareholders' approval for the additional disposal, which constituted a very substantial disposal. Wuzhou's internal controls and risk management systems contained material deficiencies. It was found that there was no mechanism and or written procedures for identifying, reporting, and executing the notifiable transactions, or for compliance with the requirements in respect of notifiable transactions under Chapter 14 of the Exchange's Listing Rules. The company did not have a system or controls in place which required the timely reporting to the board of the progress of negotiations and or the development of transactions or material transactions of the company. There were also no internal procedures and systems relating to transfers of shares and assets of the group subsidiaries. The result of these deficiencies was that it was possible for one or two directors to enter into material and or notifiable transactions and or disposals of Wuzhou's interest in its subsidiaries without the board being aware and without consideration of and compliance with the stock exchange's listing rules. Listing Rule 308 provides, amongst other things, that the stock exchange expects the directors of an issuer, both collectively and individually, to fulfil fiduciary duties and duties of skill, care and diligence to a standard at least commensurate with the standard established by Hong Kong law. Each director is subject to the obligations in the director's undertaking set out in Appendix 5B of the Listing Rules, which include, amongst other things, that he or she will comply to the best of their ability and use their best endeavours to procure the company's compliance with the listing rules and cooperate in any investigation conducted by the stock exchange. The listing committee also found that Mr. Xu Zicheng, former chairman and ED, and Mr. Xu Ziwan, former chairman, CEO and ED, breached Rule 308 and their directors' undertakings by failing to take steps to procure the company's compliance with the listing rules in respect of the transactions, allowing the registration of the purchaser in one of the transactions to proceed even before receiving the consideration for that disposal, failing to report the transactions to the board in a timely manner for its information and approval, and failing to ensure that the company established and maintained an adequate and effective internal control system and risk management system. The exchange also found that they had breached their directors' undertakings by failing to cooperate with the exchange's investigation. Given that the breaches of the two Mr. Xu's were willful and persistent and therefore warranted a public statement that, had they remained on the board and the company remained listed, the retention of office by either of them would have been prejudicial to the interests of investors. From the ruling in this case, it shows that the directors must ensure that the board is provided with appropriate information regarding transactions and that the company complies with disclosure and other requirements of the listing rules, and effective internal control systems are critical to ensuring listing rule compliance and that appropriate information is disclosed to investors on a timely basis. Directors need to establish and maintain adequate controls. The next case I'm going to talk about is the exchange's disciplinary action against two directors of CIL Holdings. On the 17th of May 2022, the stock exchange criticized two directors of CIL Holdings, Mr. Ke Junxiang, an ED and the chairman, and Mr. Fu Daoding, an executive director. The two directors failed to take sufficient steps to safeguard CIL Holdings' interests and ensure that CIL Holdings implemented and maintained adequate and effective internal controls for its money lending business. CIL Holdings commenced a money lending business in May 2014. Between June 2016 and June 2019, it granted certain loans. Their repayment dates were extended multiple times by entering into new agreements. The loans remained outstanding as at the 30th of June 2019, and substantial impairments of approximately 1.26 million Hong Kong dollars were recorded. In the CIL Holdings annual results for the year ended 30th of June 2019, the company determined the allowance for impairment losses in relation to the loans through management estimation and without supporting documentation. The company's auditors were unable to obtain adequate audit evidence to determine whether the allowance for impairment losses was appropriate and whether any adjustments were necessary, and issued a qualified opinion on CIL Holdings' annual results for the year ended 30th of June 2019. At the time, Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu were responsible for the company's money lending business and had primary responsibility for implementing internal controls for the business. During the financial year end, ended 30th of June 2018, an independent consultant was appointed to carry out an internal control review. The review identified several deficiencies in respect of CIL Holdings' money lending business. In particular, there was insufficient key financial information of some borrowers for the purpose of determining their creditworthiness with corresponding financial proof, which could not be located. Some loan agreements required the property of the borrower to be pledged. However, the relevant mortgage deeds had not been executed, causing several properties pledged, which would not be able to be foreclosed. CIL Holdings did not obtain the title deeds of the properties owned by the borrowers for the mortgage. Although there was a credit and internal control policy for the operations of the money lending business, there were no procedures dealing with loan and interest repayment defaults. Regardless, Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu failed to follow any policy which contributed to the deficiencies. In order to address the deficiencies, the board adopted a modified manual in addition to the credit and internal control policy, and Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu took steps to recover the loans, including following up with the borrowers on a weekly basis. Eventually, some of the loans were fully repaid and settled with the borrowers with the recovery of the settlement sums. The listing committee found that Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu breached listing rule 308 and their directors' undertakings as they failed to take sufficient steps to safeguard CIL Holdings' interests and ensure that CIL Holdings implemented and maintained adequate and effective internal controls in relation to the money lending business. Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu relied on their own credit assessments of the borrower's financial position and did not follow the relevant policy and procedures to acquire the relevant documentation, for example, consumer credit reports from credit reference agencies or any other independent asset valuation reports to support their assessments. So CIL Holdings could only estimate the allowance for impairment losses by exercising management judgment, which contributed to the qualified opinion. Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu did not verify ownership of the assets pledged and didn't execute mortgage deeds over the pledged assets as required by the relevant agreements. Instead, they relied only on the restrictions on dealing with the pledged assets included in the agreements. This had an adverse effect on CIL Holdings' ability to recover the loans. Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu were responsible for CIL Holdings' money lending business and had primary responsibility for implementing and maintaining an adequate and effective internal control system for the business. The internal control review found that the deficiencies were caused by the absence of procedures in the credit and internal control policy dealing with loan and interest repayment defaults, and the failure by Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu to follow the policy and the procedures thereunder. Accordingly, the exchange criticized Mr. Kerr and Mr. Fu and directed them to attend 15 hours of training each on regulatory and legal topics and listing rule compliance, including at least 3 hours on each of directors' duties and the corporate governance code within 90 days. Turning now to the third case. On the 25th of May 2022, the exchange censured CR Construction Group Holdings Limited and six of its directors, together with its controlling shareholder, Zhejiang State-Controlled Capital Operation Company. The Stock Exchange imposed the disciplinary actions for failures to disclose in the IPO prospectus and to the Stock Exchange a reorganization agreement for CR Construction's corporate structure, involving a reduction in Zhejiang SC's effective interest in CR Construction, leading to an inaccurate, incomplete, misleading, and/or deceptive prospectus. The six-month post-listing disposal restrictions under the Stock Exchange listing rules were also breached. CR Construction was listed on the exchange's main board on the 16th of October 2019 and the prospectus of the company was published on the 27th of September 2019. According to prospectus disclosures, Zhejiang SC, Zhejiang Construction Investment Group, Zhejiang Construction Group Holdings, China Zhejiang Construction Group Hong Kong, and CR Construction Investments Limited would each be a controlling shareholder of CR Construction following its listing. Zhejiang SC was to hold 45.95% of the equity interest in Zhejiang Construction Investment, and Zhejiang Construction Investment would in turn hold 72.2% of CR Construction's issued shares through a chain of its wholly owned companies. Prior to the October 2019 listing, each of these companies gave a lockup undertaking. That is, each undertook to the stock exchange that it would not, amongst other things, dispose of any shares in CR Construction in the first 6 months post-listing, that i.e. until after the 16th of April 2020. Prior to the issue of the prospectus, Zhejiang SC entered into an agreement with a number of parties in April 2019, including De Haier Group Company Limited and other shareholders of Zhejiang Construction, which involved the injection of all of Zhejiang Construction Investments assets and liabilities, including its interest in CR Construction, into De Haier, a Shenzhen-listed company, and the corresponding issue of shares by De Haier to CZI shareholders. The intention was for De Haier to replace Zhejiang Construction Investment and take its place as CR Construction's controlling shareholder. It was also anticipated that upon the completion of the reorganization, Zhejiang Construction Investment would be deregistered and cease to be a legal entity. In December 2019, the CSRC officially approved this reorganization. The reorganization was not disclosed to the stock exchange during CR Construction's listing application process, and the prospectus did not disclose any information regarding the reorganization. During the first six-month lockup period after listing, Zhejiang SC carried out the reorganization, transferring all of its interest in Zhejiang Construction Investment to De Haier, breaching the lockup undertaking. And as a result, the interest of Zhejiang SC in the intermediate controlling shareholders of CR Construction was reduced from 45.95% to 37.9%, thereby reducing the effective interest of Zhejiang SC in CR Construction. On the 25th of June 2021, Zhejiang Construction Investment was deregistered. Listing Rule 2.13.2 requires that information contained in any announcement or corporate communication required under the Stock Exchange Listing Rules, including a prospectus, must be accurate and complete in all material respects and not be misleading or deceptive. The Listing Committee found that CR Construction breached Listing Rule 2.13.2 as its prospectus was not accurate and complete in all material respects and or was misleading or deceptive because this prospectus did not include any information about the reorganization. All six relevant directors breached their directors' undertakings to use their best endeavors to procure CR Construction's compliance with the Stock Exchange Listing Rules. Prospective investors in CR Construction had a legitimate entitlement to accurate and complete information about the identity of the controlling shareholders and the shareholding structure of the company in order to make informed investment decisions. The reorganization materially impacted the accuracy and completeness of the shareholding structure information disclosed in the prospectus. The fact that CR Construction might have a listed parent could affect investors' consideration of their potential investment in the company. And all six relevant directors were aware of the reorganization when the prospectus was prepared and issued. Nevertheless, the reorganization was not disclosed to the stock exchange during the listing vetting process and CR Construction's INETs in a timely fashion so that the issue of disclosure could be explored by the full board of directors. Also, Listing Rule 10071A and the lockup undertaking required that a person or group of persons shown by the listing document issued at the time of the issuer's listing application to be a controlling shareholder of the issuer should not and should procure that the relevant registered holders should not dispose of any shares in the issuer in respect of which they are shown by that listing document to be the beneficial owners in the first 6 months after the listing date. So Zhejiang SC breached listing rule 10071A and its lockup undertaking to the exchange, and was aware that the execution of the reorganization would result in these breaches. Zhejiang SC was advised to consult the exchange and obtain its clearance prior to conducting the reorganization, but failed to follow the advice. The breaches indicated its lack of regard for the Hong Kong Exchange's listing rule compliance regime. The Exchange's Listing Committee therefore determined to impose the disciplinary actions by issuing a public censure against CR Construction, Zhejiang SC, and six directors. The Stock Exchange directed the directors to attend 20 hours of training on regulatory and legal topics. So let me move on now to consider enforcement and disciplinary actions in June 2022. I'm going to talk about the exchange's disciplinary actions against Ming Fa Group International Company and four former directors for not reporting to its board of directors various disclosable and connected transactions, and the SFC's disciplinary actions against CES Capital International for failure to manage private funds. On the 27th of June 2022, the exchange censured Ming Fa Group and two former executive directors, Mr. Huang Lien Chun and Mr. Huang Li Shui, and imposed a prejudice to investors' interests statement against a further two former directors, Mr. Wong Wen Ming and Mr. Huang Qing Ju. From 2013 to 2015, Ming Fa entered into certain agreements involving loans and disposals of assets, with some of them being viewed by the SFC as breaching the listing rules. In June 2013, Ming Fa entered into two framework agreements with two counterparties that belonged to Mr. Chen, who was the brother-in-law of Mr. Wong, the former executive director of Ming Fa, without notifying the board of directors. The agreement provided that the parties could borrow money from each other during a term of 5 years, and the loans would bear an interest rate of 20% above the bank rate at the time, payable at the end of the five-year term. Between 2013 and 2017, Ming Fa borrowed and advanced loans from and to entities pursuant to the framework agreements. The agreements were not provided to Ming Fa's auditor until March 2016. In December 2013, Ming Fa entered into eight contracts to sell the use of rights of eight villas to the two former executive directors, Mr. Wong and Mr. Huang, and their family members, as well as the family members of the two executive directors, Mr. Huang LC and Mr. Huang LS, for a sum of 189 million RMB. This constituted a connected transaction of Ming Fa. And Ming Fa failed to comply with the announcement requirements under Chapter 14A of the listing rules. There was also a requirement for full payment to be made by late December 2013, but the consideration was not fully paid until December 2015. In December 2014, Ming Fa and a purchaser entered into an agreement where Ming Fa agreed to sell a 51% equity interest in a subsidiary to the purchaser for 663 million RMB. This disposal was subsequently terminated in September 2016. The purchaser, who was a cousin of the four directors of Ming Fa, was deemed to be a connected person, and the intended disposal constituted a disposal and connected transaction of Ming Fa. Ming Fa therefore failed to comply with the requirements for announcement and independent shareholder approval under Chapters 14 and 14A of the listing rules. Mr. Wong approved and signed the equity transfer contract on Ming Fa's behalf, and while the other three directors knew about this, the rest of the board of directors did not. In March 2015, Ming Fa entered into a strategic cooperation with Wuxi Sanyang and a guarantor in relation to Ming Fa's intended investment in a property being built by Wuxi Sanyang. However, no due diligence was conducted on the matter, and a deposit of 15 million RMB was paid to Wuxi Sanyang. Under the cooperation agreement, Wuxi Sanyang was required to return the deposit after 15 months if the investment didn't materialize. Subsequently, no investment opportunity did materialize and Wuxi Sanyang went into liquidation. Ming Fa only managed to recover approximately 2.3 million RMB from the administrator in 2018. Mingfa also failed to publish or dispatch many interim and annual results and reports within the deadlines required under Chapter 13 of the listing rules. With regard to the discrepancies in relation to the fund flows that I've just described, both EY and BDO found deficiencies in Mingfa's internal controls. They found that Mingfa had no written contract management procedures and did not have reconciliation procedures for large transactions. In addition, they found that Mingfa did not have a conflict of interest policy requiring employees to declare existing and potential conflicts. The list of connected persons and notifiable transactions were not distributed to Mingfa's subsidiaries. There was no written agreement requirement for loan transactions between Mingfa and its directors, no written financing management policy, nor any retention of assessment and approval records on loan and contract terms, and Mingfa did not keep its internal audit reports. As a result, BDO recommended a number of remedial measures to Mingfa, which the Board of Directors agreed to adopt to assess the internal control deficiencies identified. These were then implemented according to Mingfa's announcement of the 30th of April 2019. From the above, the Listing Committee found that Mingfa breached the listing rules and requirements under Chapter 13, 14 and 14A, and the former directors involved breached Rule 308 of the listing rules and their directors' undertakings to comply with the listing rules to the best of their ability in relation to the various transactions and to use their best endeavours to procure Mingfa's compliance with the listing rules. The exchange censured Mingfa, Mr. Wong and Mr. QZ Huang and imposed a prejudice to investors' interest statement against Mr. LC Huang and Mr. LS Huang and directed these two former executive directors to attend 24 hours of training on regulatory and legal topics, including on listing rule compliance. Turning now to another case. On the 16th of June 2022, the SFC publicly reprimanded and fined China Everbright Securities $3.8 million Hong Kong dollars for failure to implement adequate and effective internal anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing systems and controls to guard against and mitigate the risks of money laundering and terrorist financing associated with third-party deposits between January 2015 and February 2017. In that two-year period between January 2015 and February 2017, the SFC reviewed 234 samples of client deposits and found that 76% of them were deposited by third parties, but only one was identified by China Everbright as being a third-party deposit. All these deposits amounted to over 250 million Hong Kong dollars. China Everbright claimed that it had procedures to identify third-party deposits made through its designated pool accounts maintained with various banks. However, it was discovered that the procedures did not apply to client deposits made through the sub-accounts maintained by China Everbright with a local bank. Instead, China Everbright would only conduct a monthly review where its compliance team would randomly select up to 25 client deposits in the sub-accounts and request the local bank to provide supporting documents for the selected deposits. The SFC formed a view that this monthly review was deficient in that the review was performed after the deposits had already been accepted and the sampling size was limited. Also, the local bank did not produce any written replies back to China Everbright. The SFC identified suspicious fund deposits during its investigation into the matter. It found that 11 clients received five or more deposits from multiple third parties whose relationships with the clients were unknown. The amount of net deposits received by seven clients were not commensurate with their estimated net assets. In two cases, the net amount of funds deposited into the client accounts exceeded 12 and 14 times their estimated net assets. And in one instance, five clients who did not appear to have any relationship with each other received a total of approximately 5 million Hong Kong dollars from the same third party within 4 days, and they used the funds to trade in the same stock. Despite all this, China Everbright did not detect anything suspicious, nor had it made any inquiries into the matters. With these failures, China Everbright Securities therefore breached sections 23, 51B and 51C of Schedule 2 of the AMLO, and China Everbright Securities also breached paragraphs 2.1, 5.1B, 5.1C, 5.10, 11, and 7.11 and 14 and 7.39 of the Guideline on Anti-Money Laundering and Counter-Terrorist Financing in General Principle 3, General Principle 7, and paragraph 12.1 of the SFC Code of Conduct. So the SFC was of the view that China Everbright Securities was guilty of misconduct and therefore reprimanded and fined it 3.8 million Hong Kong dollars. Turning now to the next case, on the 27th of June 2022, the SFC publicly reprimanded and fined CES Capital International 3.2 million Hong Kong dollars for failure to discharge its duties as an investment manager of two funds between February 2015 and July 2017. CES Capital failed to perform sufficient due diligence and monitor the fund's underlying investments and failed to keep a proper audit trail of the due diligence and monitoring allegedly performed on the funds and their underlying investments. CES Capital was appointed by Worldwide Opportunities Fund, SPC, to be the investment manager of two funds. These two funds were Evergreen Growth Saver SP from February 2015 to January 2018 and Hong Kong Investment Fund SP from March 2016 to January 2018. The investment purpose of the two funds was to provide shareholders with a structured investment return by investing substantially all its assets in acquiring the participating shares of a Cayman Incorporated underlying company, real estate and finance fund. In March 2016, Worldwide Opportunities Fund's directors passed a resolution to revise the investment mandate so that the underlying company for Evergreen Growth Saver SP from real estate and finance fund to another Cayman Incorporated underlying company called Evergreen Growth Saver, and said that Evergreen Growth Saver could invest in derivatives in listed or unlisted equities. The Hong Kong Investment Fund SP was similarly amended so to allow real estate and finance fund to invest in, amongst other things, derivatives and listed and unlisted equities. These amendments I'm going to refer to as the mandate change in talking about this. So as the assets of Evergreen Growth Saver SP and Hong Kong Investment Fund SP were invested exclusively in the underlying companies, the values of the funds were almost entirely dependent on the performance of the underlying companies, as well as subject to the risks of the underlying companies' investments. As such, CES Capital should have managed the fund's assets and monitored the performance of their investments by performing due diligence on the underlying companies to understand their background, business, and underlying investments in assets, as well as ongoing monitoring of the company's underlying performance and risk exposure. CES Capital, however, conducted minimal due diligence on the underlying companies and had limited or no information about the underlying companies' investments and assets and their respective holdings in them. So though CES Capital claimed that it had asked Worldwide Opportunities Fund SPC for information about the underlying company's underlying investments after the mandate change, CES HK was not able to produce any records to support this assertion or specify when the inquiries were made. Although CES Capital had been provided with valuation reports for some real estate, there was no evidence that CES Capital had taken any steps to confirm the relationships between the properties and the underlying companies, nor was there any evidence to ascertain the remaining assets, investments, and liabilities in the underlying companies' portfolios. So in terms of monitoring the performance of the funds, CES Capital only confirmed the figures in the draft valuation reports to be consistent with the fund's subscription redemption and share transfer records and recalculated the valuations to make sure they were correct arithmetically. CES Capital had no knowledge of what the underlying company's true values were. CES Capital was also unable to produce any record of the regular meetings which it had apparently taken place within its asset management department to review the performance of the funds or any discussions held in these meetings. From 30th of September to 2016 to 30th of November 2016, despite the fall of the net asset value per share of Evergreen Growth Saver SP, which fell from 2,251 Hong Kong dollars to around 546 Hong Kong dollars, CS Capital only made inquiries with Worldwide Opportunities Fund's directors, who explained that the price drop was due to a price drop in the underlying company's portfolio without taking any further action. However, this discussion could also not be proved as the record couldn't be produced. So the SFC formed the view that CS Capital had failed to perform its duties sufficiently. It had breached paragraph 1.2D of the SFC Fund Manager Code of Conduct and section 8 of the SFC Management Supervision and Internal Control Guidelines for persons licensed by or registered with the SFC. CS Capital's failures cast doubt on its ability to carry on regulated activities competently, and the SFC called into question its fitness and properness to remain licensed. As a result, a public reprimand and a fine of $3.2 million was imposed on CS Capital. I'll now consider further enforcement actions in July 2022. So on the 20th of July 2022, the SFC reprimanded RBC Investment Services Asia and fined them $7.7 million for failing to segregate client money and transferring client securities without authority. Between June 2019 and August 2020, RBC self-reported several incidents where it failed to segregate client money and transfer of client securities without standing authority from clients. And this breached the Securities Futures Client Money Rules and the Securities and Futures Client Securities Rules. The SFC then conducted an investigation into these incidents. And they found that between January 2018 and August 2020, RBC had failed to segregate client money on over 80 different occasions, with the individual transaction amounts ranging from 146 Hong Kong dollars to 52 million Hong Kong dollars. In respect of these failures, there were 68 occasions of intraday transfer of monies from client segregated accounts to its house account for settling loan repayments, making intra-group payments and payroll funding as a matter of convenience. Daily adjustments would then be made at 4 p.m. on the same day to make sure that the appropriate amount of client monies were segregated. This practice breached Section 5.1 of the Client Money Rules, which stipulates that any amount of client money shall be held in a segregated account of a licensed corporation until it's paid to the client of the licensed corporation. RBC had knowledge of this practice adopted by its staff since at least the year 2000. There were 11 incidents of calculation errors where clients' monies were under-segregated because of an inadvertent deletion of a summation formula in a spreadsheet template. This breached Section 4.4 of the Client Money Rules. On five occasions, RBC failed to pay dividends received from RBC's house account to its client segregated account within one business day after receipt of the dividends, breaching Section 4.4 of the Client Money Rules. This was caused by both a system failure and human error. There was an incident of a manual error of an RBC staff member who omitted a certain amount of client money when calculating the daily client fund segregation amount. The result of this was that there was an under-segregation of $48.5 million in the client's segregated account, breaching Section 4.4 of the Client Money Rules. There were also failures to deposit securities collateral to a recognized clearinghouse without a valid standing authority. Further, in the course of an inquiry conducted by the RBC's compliance team in March 2020, it found that the operation team had failed to renew the annual standing letter of authorization since 2011, and this standing letter of authorization was supposed to authorize RBC to deposit client securities in their margin accounts to Stock Exchange Options Clearinghouse Limited as collateral to cover the margin requirement for their open short options position. RBC then reviewed more than 2,000 options contract transactions from December 2012 to March 2020 and found that without authorization, the securities of 65 accounts of non-professional investor clients were transferred to Stock Exchange Options Clearinghouse Limited as collateral. This failure to renew the standing letter of authorization further breached sections 4, 3, 7 and 10 of the client securities rules and occurred due to a misinterpretation of the client securities rules by the then RBC's head of operations and the then compliance manager. By failing to segregate client money and transferring client securities to a clearinghouse as collateral without a valid standing letter of authorization, RBC's conduct constituted a breach of certain sections of the client securities rules and the general principles 2, 3, 7 and 8 and paragraphs 4.1, 11.1 and 12.1 of the SFC Code of Conduct. The SFC therefore reprimanded and fined RBC 7.7 million Hong Kong dollars for these breaches of the client securities rules and the SFC Code of Conduct. The next case I'm going to talk about is the SFC's reprimand and $9 million fine of Reefer Futures Limited for its failures to perform adequate due diligence, conduct adequate monitoring of client fund movements, and failing to implement a more secure login method for their clients' internet trading accounts. The SFC received numerous complaints against various licensed corporations allowing clients to place orders to their broker-supplied systems through a software called Xingguangjia, which allowed the clients to solicit investors in mainland China to trade through sub-accounts via Xingguangjia for placing orders. One complainant said that Xingguangjia permitted the licensed corporation's clients to create sub-accounts under accounts maintained with the licensed corporations, and the clients had solicited investors in mainland China to trade through the sub-accounts via Xingguangjia without having to open separate securities accounts with the licensed corporations in Hong Kong. Reefer was one of the licensed corporations in the complaint. Between May 2016 and October 2018, Reefer allowed 310 clients to use customer-supplied systems, including Xingguangjia, for placing orders. Customer-supplied systems are trading software developed and or designated by clients that enable them to conduct electronic trading through the internet, mobile phones, and other electronic channels. Reefer has its broker-supplied systems, which are trading facilities developed by exchange participants or vendors that enable the exchange participants to provide electronic trading services to investors through the internet, mobile phones, and other electronic channels. Before allowing customer-supplied systems to be connected to the broker-supplied systems, Reefer would require its clients to apply for a certificate from the vendor of the broker-supplied systems and send a request to Reefer for final approval to use the customer-supplied systems. However, Reefer didn't perform due diligence or testing on the customer-supplied systems used by its clients. It only carried out a walkthrough test on the connectivity between the customer-supplied systems and its broker-supplied systems. Although Reefer had claimed that it had relied on the broker-supplied system vendor to conduct due diligence on the customer-supplied system, the broker-supplied system vendor said that Reefer had never instructed it to conduct any due diligence or test on the customer-supplied system to examine its design and functions. The SFC said that an absence of proper due diligence work over the use of its customer-supplied systems could expose itself to major risks in unlicensed activities, money laundering, nominee account arrangements, and unauthorized access to client accounts. The SFC investigation found that there were five clients who had deposited amounts into their accounts that were disproportionate to their declared income and net worth. Apart from conducting periodic ad hoc reviews on client information and quarterly reviews on their clients' fund movements, Reefer interviewed four clients several months later for the reasons for their deposits. The clients said that such fund movements were attributed to an increase in their income derived from their investment, businesses and rent, which Reefer accepted without asking any further questions or requiring any supporting documents. Reefer therefore failed to demonstrate adequate know your client checks, proper inquiries into incommensurate deposits, timely and effective telephone calls, or hold and have clear policies and procedures. Reefer's conduct led to breaches of general principles 2 and 3 paragraphs 4.3 and 5.1 of the SFC Code of Conduct, Section 23, Section 51A, B and C of Schedule 2 to the Anti-Money Laundering and Counter-Terrorist Financing Ordinance, and paragraph 1.1 of the Guidelines for Reducing and Mitigating Hacking Risks Associated with Internet Trading. The SFC therefore found Reefer guilty of misconduct, fining it $9 million Hong Kong dollars pursuant to Section 194 of the SFO. Turning now to the next case, on the 20th of July 2022, the SFC reprimanded and fined KTF Capital Management Limited $400,000 Hong Kong dollars for failing to maintain its required liquid capital of approximately $2.8 million Hong Kong dollars between the 13th and 18th of December 2018, and did not notify the SFC when it became aware of its inability to comply with the relevant financial resources requirements. On the 13th of December 2018, KTF subscribed for shares of Fosun Tourism Group on its IPO on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. KTF subscription financed by a loan gave rise to a liquid capital deficit. After the subscription was completed, KTF entered into an assignment agreement in relation to the shares in the loan and backdated its execution date in an attempt to retrospectively prevent the liquid capital deficit from arising. Rule 4 of the Securities and Futures Financial Resources Rules provides that a licensed corporation shall at all times maintain financial resources in the amount required under Rule 4 of the FRR. For KTF, a licensed corporation that is licensed for two regulated activities, it must also at all times maintain a paid-up share capital of no less than $5 million Hong Kong dollars. Rule 6 of the FRR provides that a licensed corporation must maintain at all times liquid capital which is not less than its required liquid capital, approximately $2.8 million Hong Kong dollars in the case of KTF. Rule 27.1a of the FRR, proprietary positions of licensed corporations, provides that a licensed corporation must include in its liquid assets listed shares that it beneficially owns at market value, less the haircut amounts in relation to the relevant securities. In KTF's case, the haircut percentage applicable to the shares when calculating KTF's liquid assets was 30% in accordance with Item 1C of Table 1 in Schedule 2 to the FRR. Rule 44.1A and G of the FRR, concentrated proprietary positions, provides that where a licensed corporation holds for its own account listed shares and the net market value of any such securities, which are of the same description, equals 25% or more of its required liquid capital, it must include in its ranking liabilities, where the net market value is 51% or more of the required liquid capital, 10% of such net market value. In KTF's case, it was required to include in its ranking liabilities 5.04 million Hong Kong dollars, that's 10% of the net market value of the shares. KTF did not anticipate the FRR sums due to an oversight. The SFC calculation for KTF's liquid capital position showed that from 13th to the 18th of December 2018, the liquid capital was close to 20 million Hong Kong dollars. After becoming aware on the 17th of December 2018 that its liquid capital fell below the 120% required liquid capital, 3.36 million Hong Kong dollars, KTF did not notify the SFC as soon as reasonably practicable. The SFC was only notified 4 months later on the 26th of April 2019 by KTF's auditors. Further, when the SFC inquired about its liquid capital calculations from the 13th to the 18th of December 2018, KTF misrepresented that it had indeed maintained sufficient liquid capital during that period. KTF later clarified that the assignment agreement for the loan was backdated but failed to provide an explanation to justify the backdating of the assignment agreement. The SFC therefore considered KTF to have breached Rule 55.1a of the FRR and Section 1461 of the SFO. KTF's failure to comply with the relevant FRR requirements means that it also failed to comply with General Principle 7 and paragraph 12.1 of the SFC Code of Conduct. Accordingly, KTF was publicly reprimanded and fined $400,000 Hong Kong dollars pursuant to Section 194 of the SFO. Turning to another case, on the 28th of July 2022, the SFC banned Mr. Chan Ka-hei, a former employee of Standard Chartered Bank, from re-entering the industry for 6 months from the 28th of July 2022 to the 27th of January 2023. It was found by the HKMA that Mr. Chan had cut and pasted a customer's signature onto a form to deceive Standard Chartered Bank and an insurance company that the form was signed by the customer. Mr. Chan was employed at the time by Standard Chartered Bank as an insurance specialist in the Department of Retail Sales Specialists. The customer was residing overseas and wished to set up a direct debit authorization for her insurance policy. Mr. Chan therefore sent a change of payment mode and direct debit authorization form bank account to the customer for her signing. Originally, the document needed to be signed on pages 2 and 4, but the customer only signed on page 4. In order to set up the direct debit authorization for the customer, Mr. Chan cut the customer's signature from page 4 of the original form and pasted the cutout signature onto page 2 of a blank form and photocopied the page. Afterwards, he filled in the details by hand and pasted the cutout signature onto page 4 of the form and photocopied and dated the page. He then combined pages 1 and 3 of the original form with the composite pages 2 and 4, so it would appear that a complete set of the form was signed by the customer. Mr. Chan confirmed to the HKMA that the customer did not know about this and did not authorize him to do such an act. This incident was discovered when a Standard Chartered Bank staff member found page 2 of the composite form left unattended inside the photocopying machine at the branch where Mr. Chan worked. The HKMA referred the case to the SFC due to Mr. Chan ceasing to be registered as a relevant individual with the HKMA in May 2021. The SFC concluded that Mr. Chan breached section 129 of the SFO and was not a fit and proper person to be a registered person carrying on regulated activities honestly. Turning now to another case. This related to the SFC's action in August 2022, in which it reprimanded and fined TC Capital $3 million Hong Kong dollars for failing to discharge their duties as a sponsor in a Stock Exchange GEM IPO listing application of China Candy. The action was brought by the SFC pursuant to Section 194 of the SFO, in which the SFC found that TC Capital failed to conduct reasonable due diligence on the third-party payment arrangement and failed to maintain proper records of due diligence work. The SFC stated that its investigation revealed that approximately 45% of the revenue generated by China Candy during the track record period was contributed by its two top customers, which I'll refer to as the customers, who settled most of their payments to China Candy through third-party payers. Third-party payments by customers, in particular by major customers or top customers of a listing applicant, are known as red flags, as these kind of third-party settlement methods of payment could be used to disguise the true beneficial owner and or source of funds. Serious consideration should be given by a sponsor regarding customers of in a IPO listing applicant which makes payment via third parties, as this could potentially facilitate a fraudulent scheme, particularly if the third parties are connected, for instance, to any suppliers of the stock exchange listing applicant. The SFC said that it was further revealed in the investigation that Mr. Edward Wu Wen Guang, who was a responsible officer and sponsor principal of TC Capital in charge of the listing application of China Candy, was aware of the third-party payments in the course of preparing the exchange's IPO listing application. However, even though third-party payments by the customers were clearly present in the sample transaction documents obtained by TC Capital, the issue was not made a matter falling within the ambit of the due diligence plan. Also, no inquiries and/or further follow-up due diligence work was conducted to ascertain the extent of the third-party payments and the rationale for using this payment method. The SFC found that TC Capital had failed to conduct all reasonable due diligence and exercise professional skepticism in respect of the third-party payment arrangements. TC Capital was therefore in breach of General Principle 2 and paragraphs 17.2b, 17.4a, 17.6a, 17.6b, and 17.6c of the SFC Code of Conduct, and paragraph 5.1 of the SFC Corporate Finance Advisor Code of Conduct, and paragraphs 2 and 3 of Practice Note 2 to the GEM listing rules. A stock exchange IPO sponsor is required to maintain proper and accurate records of due diligence performed, together with its assessment of whether these results are able to provide a proper audit trail of work done upon request by the SFC. In cases where the matter bears some significance, even if a conclusion has been reached that the matter is not sufficiently material to warrant disclosure, the Stock Exchange IPO sponsor is expected to maintain documentation showing how such a conclusion has been reached. The SFC's investigation found that TC Capital failed to maintain proper records of the due diligence work which it claimed to have performed in relation to the Stock Exchange GEM IPO listing application of China Candy. In particular, it was found that where there were no records showing how TC Capital inquired about the third-party payments and or came to the conclusion that the third-party payments were immaterial so as to not warrant disclosure in China Candy's prospectus, and no audit trail demonstrating that TC Capital had turned its mind to certain discrepancies identified in the due diligence documents and the conclusion which it had reached concerning the inconsistent information as to the ownership of the customers. In respect of these failures, the SFC considered that TC Capital failed to demonstrate that it had conducted reasonable due diligence and had properly considered the third-party payments and the discrepancies of information from the due diligence documents. TC Capital was therefore in breach of General Principles 2 and 7 and paragraphs 12.1, 17.2e and 17.10 of the SFC's Code of Conduct and paragraph 2.3 of the CFA Code of Conduct. As Mr. Wu was the Stock Exchange listing sponsor principal in charge of the Stock Exchange GEM IPO listing application and the supervision of the transaction team, which led to the failures of TC Capital, the SFC considered that TC Capital's failures were attributable to Mr. Wu's failure to discharge his duties as a Stock Exchange GEM IPO sponsor principal, a responsible officer, and a member of the senior management of TC Capital. In particular, the SFC formed a view that Mr. Wu had breached General Principles 2 and 9, as well as paragraphs 4.2 and 14.1 of the SFC Code of Conduct and paragraph 133 of the SFC Additional Fit and Proper Guidelines for Corporations and Authorized Financial Institutions Applying or Continuing to Act as Sponsors and Compliance Advisors with respect to his failure to exercise due skill, care, and diligence in handling the Exchange IPO listing application, to diligently supervise the transaction team, to carry out the Stock Exchange IPO sponsor work, and to ensure the maintenance of appropriate standards of conduct by TC Capital. So that brings me to the conclusion of this presentation. Thank you very much and have a lovely evening.